seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
You're welcome along to a US Open special, Golf Weekly. We are very excited. It is here, the second major of 2017. If it's as good as the Masters, we're in for a treat. Nathan Murphy is here. Hello.
Hey, Joe.
And Fionn Davenport is back.
Hey, Joe.
From his travels. And you had a good time.
I had a great time.
Good.
Play any golf?
I didn't. I watched a lot of golf.
Washington, we'll get on to that. Yeah. Washington, D.C. and...
New York.
Wow.
And that was in Orlando as well.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. Yeah. It was brilliant.
How are they feeling in old D.C. about politics?
This is so weird. So obviously, it's a big tourist town, mostly domestic tourism as well as international. So lots of people from all over America want to go to the nation's capital. They want to see its most famous buildings, the White House, the Capitol building, the Lincoln Memorial. The amount of people taking selfies, giving the finger to the White House was Now, it just made me laugh after a few days because I'd walk by the White House most days. And it just made me laugh. I was just like, really? And there's a palpable sense, particularly when they hear that you're foreign, they go, oh, like they're panicked. Like, I mean, in the 200 odd years of American history, like, you know, they had a civil war 150 years ago. But like compared to Europe, it's not as if they've had like major, major problems, you know. And so the election of a guy who a lot of people feel is clearly unsuited to the office has really thrown them for a loop. Now, the people who like him are so dug in and they're like, no, they, you know, they're almost like, anyway, but it was very interesting indeed.
I'm sure it was. Yeah. Mm. Very good. Well, you're welcome back.
Thank you.
And so there's lots going on. I mean, you missed the whole Tiger Woods thing, and we'll come back to that another time, I would say, because we've got to focus on the US Open mostly for
today.
Well,
you did check into rehab this week.
I hadn't seen that.
What?
He checked into rehab.
Where?
Where did you see this? Because I haven't seen this.
The Telegraph had it.
Anywhere. Right.
The Daily Telegraph had it. They picked it up off somewhere else, and he checked into rehab, and the story goes he's checked in for dealing with addictions to Xanax and Vicodin.
What?
Yes.
Can I just, want to put a major health warning in this. How has this not been everywhere? Like, I understand the Telegraph got it.
Is this not the biggest one of the,
no,
like, this is bigger than the car crash?
Because he also had checked into, they're saying, I was listening to another podcast and Paul Azinger was on it. And Paul Azinger was freely discussing Tiger's addiction issues. Freely, openly discussing. Basically saying that at this stage, he's more concerned with Tiger the man, not so much. He doesn't care about Tiger the golfer. He just wants Tiger the man to fix his problems. He wishes that his friends, those few friends that he has and that he has confided in over the years, would kind of lean in and really, because he needs their support more than ever. One of the details is that he's rented out the top floor, the whole male wing of whatever rehab center he's checked into, which is a bit odd. But he's in rehab. Tiger's in rehab.
How is this not the biggest story on the week of the US Open? I would have thought, first question to Rory McIlroy, Tiger's in rehab.
I have to say, it's what's at the back of my mind, I'm saying, Fionn's made some kind of mistake here.
Okay, well, you guys talk away.
And you're going to Google
it. I'm going to Google it. I'm going to Google the story now. Just to confirm, because I'm now doubting it, because you two haven't heard it.
No, not only have we not heard it, you said this to me this morning, and the first thing I did when I got into the office was look for this story. It's not on the Golf Channel. It's not on the Guardian Golf. I mean, I'm sure it's on some websites. I'm sure TMZ probably have it, but there was no...
There you go. Have a look at that.
Okay.
If you write... Maybe you're not very good at using Google, because the first thing that comes up when you press Tiger Rehab is the Telegraph, Tiger checks into rehab.
Tiger checks into rehab for addiction to prescription painkillers. Daily Mail, Tiger Woods checks into rehab to keep custody of kids.
Yes, that was the other thing.
How did I miss this story?
I don't know.
When did this come out?
It was on AMP yesterday. They say Tiger Woods reportedly checks into rehab clinic. They haven't been able to verify that. They're the only three sources, though. I feel like the Daily Mail have got stuff wrong before.
Are they coming all from the same...
Could
AMP
be, yeah.
Source
it could be.
Who reportedly says it?
Yes, they are actually.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
The reason why I find it surprising is that every opportunity that the US media, sorry, that all golf media have.
I agree.
To ask a question of a leading player about Tiger Woods, they will.
Yeah.
And him going into rehab takes this to a whole new level because it gets rid of any speculation.
They're also saying that he had checked into rehab in 2010 for an addiction to Vicodin.
The golfer is said to have booked out the entire male inpatient unit at the Jupiter Medical Center for 28 days to be treated for painkiller addiction. Radar Online cites an anonymous source.
Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay,
I'll just finish it.
Go on.
Who said the stint aims to settle the concerns of his ex-wife, Elin. A pair of shared custody, blah, 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 blah. But part of the agreement was that was to avoid any public scandal in order to keep his share. If he breaks it, he could see his time with the children cut by 20%, leaving them with Elin 70% of the time and giving him just 30%.
Do you know what Radar Online is?
Sorry. Woods' long-term agent, Mark Steinberg, also declined to address the reports. Now, I think if you're Steinberg, you denied the reports if they're not true.
Absolutely.
Don't you?
It's Radar Online, which seems
to be... TMZ break a lot.
Well, it is
stories.
A version of TMZ.
Yeah. And TMZ break true stories. Like, I mean, you know, there might be something disreputable. And again, the point of bringing it up is I'd read it in the Telegraph, so I just assumed that it was one of those stories that was percolating into the media today. And...
May well do.
We'll be talking to Rex Hoggart in a minute. We can ask him why nobody has brought this up.
Okay, wow, interesting. So there's been some controversy here in Golf Weekly Towers. Don't mention the war. Tom O'Neill, I'm pretty sure we were promised a Wednesday podcast this week, hashtag friend of the pod. Gerald O'Dwyer, hi gents, you mentioned last week there'd be a pod on Wednesday. Is there one coming today? He asked yesterday, hashtag FOTP. And Bradley, I heard an off the ball this evening that there was a US Open pod, he questions. Well.
Whew. Go on, you can explain.
We recorded 45 to 50 minutes yesterday, Nathan and I and Dave. We had off the ball to do that that evening. It was put a lot of stress on the whole situation and I had to rush out. It was about 5 o'clock and start then prepping for off the ball that evening. And Dave was in. I said, well, can you edit this? Because I'm busy. And he said, yeah, sure. So around 6:30 or so, he's, you know, and he'd been checking. Do I put the sting there? Yeah. The intro sting there? Yeah. All that stuff. So he's working away. And then he said to me around 6:30, right, that is edited now and it's in the system. And I took that to mean.
It's up online.
Yeah. What he meant by in the system was it's saved where it was saved already. Now, look, he was blaming me this morning. Clearly, I'm not wrong. Maybe 15%. I just thought, oh, that's a weird way of saying in the system. That's a weird way of saying it's on podcast. Mm. Look,
Nathan, the bigger question is why he just left us in the system.
I mean, I was going on air. To be fair, he was too, but he had another half hour before we were going on. Why not just upload it?
In terms of great off-the-ball screw-ups, is this above... Fionn pressing pause.
It's below.
Or below.
It's below.
Oh, it's miles below.
It's way below.
Way below.
We did a 45-minute pod.
We did a 45-minute pod yesterday.
Yeah, but it's there. I mean, well, theoretically, you could put it up now.
We could. The worst thing about Fionn pressing pause at the time was you and I were down at the Irish Open at K Club
for
new friends of the pod. We were at the Irish Open. Fionn was here, so we have to record it back here. We were just on a line like the way Nick Dye would be. And so we did 45, 50 minutes. Really good. I had to rush to meet my girlfriend for dinner. And then Fionn said, I've hit save and there's nothing here. You'd pressed pause. You know the way pause and record are sometimes intertwined.
Yeah. No, I made the mistake.
What made that worse was we then had to just start again right away.
Yeah.
Everything was very fresh. There was no difference. It was the same three people. At least Fionn here is bringing...
At least we got rid of Dave.
Tiger Woods news.
Mine was definitely a worse mistake. Definitely.
It was horrific. I do remember repeating myself.
Wow, you never said that at the time.
No, I remember...
you weren't there sitting beside him in the booth at the K Club. Like, the look in his eyes said it all.
What class of a dickhead is you?
Oh, stop. And I remember making jokes and even my delivery wasn't as good second time around and the laughs... Like, you were fake laughing, Fionn. Nathan, you weren't even trying. But Fionn had his guilt was fake laughing.
I know. It's all still now. It burns me up inside.
Will you fake laugh at all the jokes that I told yesterday? That
absolutely
I'm going to repeat.
Will. No, I will. I will. And Fionn will laugh because he's hearing them fresh. That was
it's
so bad.
All fresh.
That was what it was so bad. We had to the three same people had to go again there and then.
It's awful.
Oh, that was bad. But this wasn't. I mean, this was not good from McIntyre. Am I wrong, by the way? My argument is never in the 10 years I've been here and 3, 4, 5 years that we've all been knocking around and off the ball, does someone use the phrase, it's in the system, about just being in the News Talk Surf file?
I have, when I used to work here.
I would think you would say it's in the system if the system is the last place it's meant to be left.
Sort of.
Rather than, I've edited it, and rather than taking the 5 minutes it takes to complete the entire process and, you know, release it to the wider world,
yeah,
I've just kind of left it there.
Because if Dave says it's in the system, unfortunately, the next question should be, hang on a second, have you uploaded it? Because you're like, because the only thing Dave should be saying is, I've edited and it's been uploaded.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. He should have just said, I've edited. Because the adding in of, and it's in the system.
Where else would it be?
Where else would it be?
That's where it was originally.
I saved it on my floppy disk.
Yeah. Whereas if he had just said, that's edited now. I would have been like, okay.
Well, no, we're all in full agreement that Dave is to blame for this.
I would have probably thought, you lazy git, you could have uploaded it. But I would have known it's not uploaded. But he said, and it's in the system. Come on. I'm not angry about it, clearly.
No. Tiger's in rehab. No,
it's not like we were busy yesterday evening trying to squeeze in that Golf Weekly recording.
That was the other thing. A lot of stress.
Yeah, I know. Because I was on the WhatsApp group and I was following the texts, you know, oblivious to it all. And then I thought, yeah, but, Joe's not on. And then I turned on Off the Ball. And sure enough, you were with Jerry and Keith talking rugby.
We sure were. So anyway, I don't want to talk any more about Dave McIntyre or what happened. I don't think there's any point in putting up that podcast at this stage.
Let's listen back later over the weekend and if there's something really prescient that we say. Maybe I'm going to go for 3 different predictions this time round.
Various tweets in. Paul Willoughby, quite interestingly, sent us a lovely picture. Listening to Golf Weekly while mowing the fairways at Erin Hills this week. Happy times. Hashtag friend of the pod. Hashtag new friend of the pod.
Bloody right, new friend of the pod.
Yeah, I mean, wow.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's quite nice to think of the groundkeepers. The groundkeepers?
Groundskeeper.
Groundskeeper.
But what if there's more than one groundskeeper?
Then it's groundskeepers.
Right. Very interesting. The groundskeeper.
Yeah, it's like...
makes a lot of sense.
You know the way they talk about attorney general? Mm-hmm. So if you have a multiple, it's the attorneys general.
Wow. That's the touch of class this guy brings to the pod.
We missed that.
Could you imagine?
This is why, in a way, it's possibly a good thing Dave McIntyre didn't put up yesterday's podcast.
Do you imagine me, you, McIntyre, trying to figure out what the plural of attorneys general was? Be here all afternoon. Attorney generi?
Is there a lot of pressure?
Actually, I'd like that.
That's funny.
Is there a lot of pressure on greens, keepers, or does the equipment just look after everything?
Is it green keeper?
We know it as green keeper, don't we?
We do.
Yeah.
Because you're on the grounds.
Yeah.
So that's groundskeeper. But then I would think it's just green keeper as opposed to greenskeeper.
I mean, you're keeping all of the greens, but in the moment you're keeping one green. Yeah, sure. But it is green keeper.
It's green keeper and groundskeeper.
Yeah.
Look, I'm glad we figured that out. Paul Willoughby, who also tweeted in and added, it's always just jaw-dropping to see how far Dustin Johnson can hit the ball. You know, when you see it in person. I mean, I've seen him do it a few times at British Opens. Mm.
And they're going out chopping the fairway. Are they thinking, no, we'd be safe here. It'll be fine.
He made that point. He said, we thought we were fine at certain points, and then, oh my God, he has reached us.
Paul, feel free to tweet whatever impressions you have, you know, watching these guys up close,
yeah, sure.
If you are there over the weekend.
And spread the word about Golf Weekly to
your
fellow groundskeepers.
We'd come visit, but from what we hear, it's quite difficult to get to.
Yes. Meant to be in the middle of nowhere. Wisconsin, it's in the state of Wisconsin, obviously north of Chicago and near Lake Michigan. Milwaukee is the nearest city.
Yeah.
Home to the Fonz.
Are we talking making a murderer country?
Yes, we are.
You'd an interesting story about that.
So, Steve Trattner is the guy, along with Bob Lang, who owned the land, who they dreamed of building a US Open course here. So not long after the course finally opened, Steve Trattner, who I think had a job at the course, he pleaded no contest to first-degree murder of his wife and was sentenced to 35 years in prison and is doing his time in the same prison as Stephen Avery from Making a Murder.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
I do remember when I watched Making a Murderer.
I want Stephen Avery
and Steve Stricker just to see was there any had they ever come across each other at some stage.
I am me and my girlfriend to this day can't stop doing impressions of poor. Is it Brendan, the young lad who's in prison?
No, he's out.
Is he out? But like, so you know, do you want a cup of tea? I don't know.
I don't know. It's a bit Fargo, eh?
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. You either do or you don't.
Yeah. Poor Brendan, fairness. And fairness, poor Brendan has mental health issues.
Like, oh, it's really dreadful. Chronic.
The accent derives from because Minnesota and Wisconsin was very, very popular destination for Scandinavian immigrants as far back as the 1880s. So when they moved across, like Germans went to Chicago and other cities in the east, but like the Scandinavians tend to almost go exclusively to Minnesota and Wisconsin. So they're English. That English accent that you hear in Fargo or in Making a Murderer, that's where they get that inflection from. It's from Swedish and Norwegian. And
I feel like he's showing off now.
Is Wisconsin seen as sort of been the back arse of beyond?
No.
I just wonder, every time they talk about Steve Stricker and he's gone home for the winter. Mm-hmm.
It's cold.
He ain't getting back anytime soon.
Is that why the Scandinavians went there, presumably?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I always think with, isn't it? I mean, I don't know.
You would think if you emigrated from Scandinavia, you'd want to go to LA. You know, if I was going there, I wouldn't be going somewhere where it rains 300 days a year.
But don't you go where
the first
your cousins
go.
Went?
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, that's, you kind of follow in a you path. Do. But I mean, when they say go home, I'm like, it gets to like 40 below up there in winter.
Yeah. Because Steve Stricker, when he was, you know, remastering his game, and I presume even now while he still hits, he hits out of like a mobile home. So they've just, as the door opener, maybe they've cut a slightly bigger door and they have all the heat on in the mobile home. And that's where Steve Stricker hits his balls from.
This is tin cup stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's very tin cuppy.
Yeah.
I'm your man for Steve Stricker trivia.
Oh, yeah.
God, I love that.
You've got some Bob Lang trivia, though. Like you, about the other guy, Steve Tratton, the guy who owned the land.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't there like some, not quite as...
Well, it was a stream toast to the US Open. He went bankrupt, and I mean, I think within like a week or a month or two of having to sell the course due to bankruptcy, the course got the US Open. Like, so it's tragedy. There should be a 30 for 30 meets Making a Murderer of what happened to the Erin Hills boys.
And they're worried about there not being a narrative around Erin Hills. Holy moly.
It's not really the one golf.
I was going to say, this is golf. Any other sport, they'd be thinking, wow, the history.
I know.
Golf is like, no, it's never happened.
I don't think Jim Nance or Joe Buck or any of the boys will.
Oh, God, listen to me. I had a flavor of Jim Nance and Jack Nicklaus at Memorial live when I was in America. And I was like banging my head off the TV. So they told a story about Jack Nicklaus, who famously has written a letter to the sponsors of every major since 1962, and as a form of courtesy to thank them for making the major possible. And in the last 20-odd years has also written another letter to the winner of said major to congratulate them, which is an old-fashioned courtesy. But the way they told the story, it was like he took 4 months out of his life every year to go help starving children in Africa. The man was such a humanitarian. And it was just like, my favourite part. So you have Nicklaus, who's just being Nicklaus, Jim Nance, who, if Jim Nance could build an altar to Jack Nicklaus and worship at said altar, he would. But my favourite part is Nick Faldo, who is the third member of the trio. If Nick Faldo could do an eye roll, he would have. He was looking away going, ugh, when does this bit end?
So Jack only writes letters to major winners and also writes letters to major sponsors.
Oh, yes.
Arnie writes a letter, or wrote a letter, to everybody who won a tournament.
Wow.
Every PGA Tour event, and I think possibly European Tour events as well.
More important to write to the sponsors. You know what I'm saying? Jack, who shamelessly in the last year or two is bringing on kids and force-feeding them his ice cream and saying, it's so nice, isn't it? Do you want to ask Jack a question while you eat my ice cream? Available in good stores nationwide.
In a country that's fighting an obesity epidemic.
I know. Jack was like, more ice cream. That's what this country needs.
Jack played in 44 US Opens in a row.
Yeah.
That's a lot of letters.
Wow.
44!
Yeah. Look, he's an impressive man in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Although, I've been saying as well that at one point, Nance was saying, wow, Jack, I wouldn't think many players take the time to do that. And Jack just said, well, they should.
They should. Jim was Jack also, he's an old-fashioned guy, so he never misses an opportunity to remind the younger generation of what a bunch of shitehawks they are.
But where does that start? At what age? So should Rory now, when Jason Day wins, Rory should write him a letter.
And to the sponsors.
That's what Jack is saying. Now, in part, I kind of agree in the sense of, like, it's an old-fashioned courtesy.
No, it's a nice thing to do.
It is a nice thing to do.
But they don't need to talk about it, like, as you said, he's gone and helped out starving kids for 4 months.
That's exactly
it. If anything, it means he has a bit too much time on his hands.
Does he even write them himself?
That's another fair question, I think, to ask. As a journalist, you're allowed to ask that question.
Yeah.
What's our favourite Jim Nance story? It involves a photograph he carries around with him.
Burnt toast.
It's the most Alan Partridge thing ever. This is Jim Nance did a great interview, which you should check out somewhere. You can tell it there because it's just beautiful.
Well, so Jim, like all golf journalists and golf reporters, has to spend a good chunk of his life in hotels.
A lot of travel. Like,
actually, this is a great idea for you, Fionn.
You.
It might make your life a lot easier and you might be a far happier human being.
I'm listening
at the end
because
of it.
Yeah. I would love anything to lift it.
Every morning you get up and you want to have a routine. You want to maybe have a reasonably healthy breakfast. You might just have your one slice of toast. You're not at home. You know how you like it at home. So you want your one slice of toast exactly as you'd have it at home.
Absolutely.
That's a hard thing to do when you're in a hotel.
Mm. Yeah.
Jim Nance likes burnt toast.
Burnt toast.
Like crispy black.
But to a certain shade of black. Not overly brown. Not overly black. Just black. And how do you explain that?
Is it 8 on the toaster or 9?
I'd say it's more 9.
I'm a six man as well. Yeah.
So to help him out,
Jim said he was always giving head about it. He's like, so I order the toast and I tell him I want it burnt. And the waitress is kind of like, okay.
If I come back with it burnt in this 5-star hotel we're staying in,
I'll get fired.
Exactly.
And so Jim has to send them back again. Mm. Burn it. And like, always complaining to his wife about this.
I'm confused. What is the solution?
He carries around a photograph of perfectly burnt toast to show the waitress as an example.
Because Jim was arguing in the article, it wastes 5 to 10 minutes of my morning every morning. So this now saves me, over the course of a year, hours.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant.
He said it without a hint of just...
Nathan,
Jim Nance says everything without a hint of anything.
He's the cheesiest man that's ever lived. Nathan, isn't there another legend of golf who's written a letter in the last week that you shared with us?
Oh, yeah. This needs a segment all on its own. I was hoping, actually, that Joe might read it in full.
Oh, no, I can't do that.
In full Gary Player accent. But then I saw earlier today that somebody else had also thought of that idea.
Okay.
And gone and read this letter. So this is a letter from our favourite South African, Mr. Gary Player. He had a little bit of a row.
Nelson Mandela, close second.
With Robert Trent. Well, Nelson Mandela comes up in this. Nelson comes up in this story as well. So, Gary Player had a bit of an argument with Robert Trent Jones Jr. about the US Open in 2015.
Oh, yeah.
At Chambers Bay.
That was when he did his big rant about the future of golf and the amount of water it takes up and all that stuff. Yeah, I remember that.
So, my understanding is Robert Trent Jones Jr. was doing an interview with one of the golf magazines over the last couple of months and was talking about Chambers Bay and the criticism and spoke about an argument he had at the time with Gary Player. Mm-hmm. So he obviously took issue with what Player said. They had a bit of a back and forth. Player seemed to think that this argument was off the record and would never be spoken about in public.
Fair enough.
So next thing he's reading Golf Digest and this is there and he's not quite happy about it. So he's written a lengthy letter. Not very good for radio that I'm holding it up to show you how lengthy his letter is.
That's long.
I don't think I should read the entire thing, but he says...
That's 5 paragraphs.
You can imagine my surprise and bemusement when reading the recent article by John Strage from Golf Digest in which Robert Trent Jones Jr. yet again raised my comments about the diabolical condition of Chambers Bay a few years ago during the US Open. Sorry, the headline for the letter is... Let Sleeping Dogs Lie.
Okay.
And it's on official Gary Player paper.
He gave his own letter a headline.
Yes.
Does Jack Nicklaus do that when he writes to the sponsors or the winners?
Nah, Jack keeps it humble.
Does money coming.
Does he say things like, to Jason Day, your day at last. Dear Jason.
Like a pun.
Hear the roars.
Absolutely. But it just... Well, so Gary Player, Let Sleeping Dogs Lie is the headline.
Let Sleeping Dogs Lie is the headline.
Interesting.
The comments made 2 years ago by Chambers Bay no doubt were justified. I certainly was not the only one who spoke about the design or condition of the course.
Yeah.
Rory McIlroy, Henrik Stenson, Billy Horschel, Sergio Garcia and many others expressed their distaste for the course and how it was presented. Yeah. It was no secret the players and fans were unhappy with the setup, condition and inability to walk the course as a spectator. I wasn't at Chambers Bay that year randomly. I was invited to celebrate the anniversary of my career Grand Slam victory, which I completed 50 years earlier at the US Open. The only other golfers in this club are Gene Sarazen, Ben Hogan, Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger Woods. For the record, I never even knew Robert Trent Jones was at Sunningdale attending the Senior Open, nor why would he have any reason to attend. And during the Olympics in Rio, I approached him directly to bury the hatchet. In front of many witnesses, he made a big scene and later apologised. Of course, this was accepted by me, and I thought we'd all moved on. Clearly he is not, and chose to blatantly lie to Golf Digest about what happened. Whilst he seems to be suffering from either amnesia or senility, I do wish he would come to peace with what happened during the US Open and just get on with his life. It really is time to move on. Enough is enough. I am not responsible for what happened at Chambers Bay. We all make mistakes and simply have to accept the consequences and learn from them. I had the privilege of spending time with Nelson Mandela, who was imprisoned for 27 years.
Oh, no.
Don't play that card, Gary. Don't.
Don't tell people he was in prison for 27 years.
And if anyone had a reason to have hatred and revenge in their heart, it was him. Yet, he did not.
Oh, my God. Is he comparing his dispute with Robert Trent Jones Jr. to Nelson Mandela?
I advised Mr. Jones in Rio that he should take a leaf out of Mr. Mandela's book. He has very obviously and sadly not done so. My very best to the USGA and all those players competing in the US Open this year at Erin Hills. Hopefully, this will be the focus and not anything else. Sincerely, Gary Player.
Well, there's nothing we need to say about that, really, is there? That can stand alone.
One little thing.
So we have Jack. We no longer have Arnie writing letters to every tournament winner. We have Jack thanking the sponsors, keeping the money flowing. And we have him congratulating the major winners. If we had Gary Player, just on random issues, writing these letters every couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So he's not happy with Jason Day's slow play. Mm-hmm. He puts in here all day long.
Yeah, we haven't got all day.
Yeah.
We have.
And just takes him down.
Like that's just one pun after another.
No, I would love to be a headline writer.
You could be.
Yeah.
You should be. Wow. Yeah, well, you know, I mean.
I'm moving on with tweets because we have to get to Rexelgard. So Thomas Kenny sent us this picture. Sorry, Nathan, you can't see it. I've just opened on the computer here. Listening, well, on a very sweaty tube, but excited for his first ever round in golf tomorrow. Hashtag struggle off 12. Hashtag original friend of the pod.
That's too long.
Which is an interesting.
It's long. It's too long as a hashtag. And I respect the fact that he was there at the beginning, but.
Well, he might think he was there at the beginning. When
were you here at the beginning?
No. No, Jer Gilroy was here at the beginning, and...
Who else?
Me.
You?
Were you here at the beginning?
What? Do you think it was Jer Gilroy and Mick McCarthy's idea to start a golf podcast? I mean, really?
Well, Jer does like free golf, which I'm assuming was his reason for getting involved.
No, of course I was.
He should go, here's a good, for original friend of OG, like instead of original...
No, there's just
friend of the pod, for God's sake.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
Not there may come a time, you know, where we want money from people and we'll start ranking them in order. But right now, everybody's a friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod. Although I was listening to Jon Favreau's Pod Saves America, and they were talking about some senator that they'd interviewed. And he goes, yeah, he's a friend of the pod. And I was like, no.
Yeah. Paul O'Neill says, look what arrived in the post today. All my tickets for At The Open. Hashtag emotional. Hashtag excited. Hashtag are you going?
So yesterday we made a joke about the Open being the Irish Open.
Yeah, we presume he means the Dubai.
Should we go there again?
The Dubai Irish Open.
Dubai Duty Free Irish
in
Open.
Port Stewart.
Yeah. Presented by the Rory Foundation.
Yeah.
We've just added Hideki Matsuyama.
And Rafa Cabrera-Bello in the last
Cabrera-Bello,
24
yeah.
hours as well. Dubai Duty Free Irish Open, they're our partners, they're our sponsors at the moment.
Just sorting out our accommodation.
Oh yeah.
Close to the course.
Excellent. Very good news.
What, when is it?
Don't worry about it, Fionn.
First week in July.
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, it's on the horizon.
Am I...
Of course you're invited.
Is there room for one little fella?
Sleep on the floor somewhere, a cupboard or something. David Gibson, hey lads, love the pod. Very worried for Kevin Na this week. How's he going to count all the shots from that rough? Boom, boom.
Oh, I can't hit the ball. Oh, I'm swinging so...
Yeah. We'll play the Kevin Na interview in a moment. Jonathan Kennedy was obviously listening to Off The Ball last night. Joe, only real golfers have arthritis. Phil, Ollie, you and I.
Did you reveal this?
I mentioned it last night, yeah.
I only found out about this morning. I have to say,
I went to the, my big toe's been giving me a lot of trouble for the last while. It's getting worse and really affected my golf swing, you know? And I went to the physio and she, I mean, she was checking it out and doing the various tests and comparing it to the other toe. And she's like, yeah, look, I hate to tell you, but you probably got arthritis there in that big toe, wear and tear and various things. And I was like, it's a very debilitating thing.
Does it come and go?
A little bit, yeah.
I get it once every 2-3 months at the back of my knee and on my big toe.
You have arthritis as well.
It's in my family.
Oh.
Must be in mine at some level if I'm getting it at 32. But it's, well, it's a killer.
Like, I played golf with Joe this morning and you could see it really affecting his swing.
Well, if you think at the top of the swing, you got to exert quite a lot of force through the inside of your right foot. Your big toe is pretty important there to push forward. So I can feel myself at the top and your brain says, if you shoot down now through your foot, you're going to be sore. So I'm doing all sorts. Like I'm half avoiding it. Like I was flashing my hips instead of putting the weight through my feet. And like it was all, the club gets stuck behind you and it's, the ball flares off to the right. So it's actually, I don't know. I'm going to have to get it sorted out somehow or else just pop a shed load of painkillers every time I play. Anyway.
Vicodin's good for that guy.
Yeah. Ronan Coughlin was in touch. He was looking at Matt Kuchar being rather rude, I think, blanking completely Andrew Coulthard. He said, Cooch gone down in my estimations. He's chipping off the tee box, for Christ's sake. Rude comes to mind. What do you think? I wholeheartedly agree with that, Ronan.
Do you?
Yeah, I tweeted out last night, like, what is the story with this Matt Kuchar?
So there's the clip. There's the Sky Sports, the clip they put on Twitter, which I think everyone has seen, which is about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
You saw it live.
Yeah, well, I saw it and then they repeated the show. So, I mean, Sky did a great job last night, by the way, on the range with Sarah Sturck. McGinley and Butch were excellent. Like, as good as McGinley and Butch have been, I think maybe just being out of the studio freed them up a bit. They were throwing good stuff around, really interesting info and thoughts. But so Coulthard's going around, and I'm not sure who Matt Kuchar's playing partner is at this point, but Coulthard's chatting to him, clearly, you know, doing that roving mic thing, bit of a chat, blah, blah, blah. And Kuch, as Ronan says, is not hitting a shot that he's going to have to replicate over the next 4 days. He is chipping off the 14th tee box, just down a really steep hill for the crack onto the 15th green.
Mm.
And Coulthard is, you know, you can look at the clip yourself. He probably starts talking to him as he's hitting the shot, but it's not, you know, it's just, it's just a chip. It's a nothing shot. It's not a serious thing. And then Coulthard kind of thinks, okay, I'll shut up. And he holds the mic there for a sec. And then he's holding the mic at Kuch. Kuch is still watching the ball land and the ball stops. And even the playing partner realizes it's a bit odd and kind of makes a quip. And Coulthard turns back to him, makes a quip, and then turns back to Kuch and half says, you going to talk to me, Kuch?
No, doesn't he say? He's not saying much of anything.
Something.
Yeah.
And Kuchar doesn't even like look over his right shoulder. Completely blanks him. And Coulthard moves on. So there's three short options, okay? One, this was some kind of joke. You know, and it's like
blank the TV guy.
And as soon as the camera went off, him and Coulthard started roaring, laughing at each other, and Coulthard saying, you asshole, and it's funny. Mm. Two, there is a personal issue between Coulthard and Kuchar. Kuchar doesn't like Coulthard. Or three, Kuch with his aw shucks, I'm such a nice guy thing, is actually a bit of an asshole at times. Because like, to ignore someone like that was really uncomfortable. It's just a weird thing to do.
I read it as option two.
He doesn't like Coulthard.
Straight away, the body language suggested that, oh, there's a bit of history here and he doesn't like him.
I was wondering, but if was there history? Did he know who Coulthard was? Would he definitely know who Coulthard is?
Maybe not definitely, but he is like a former Ryder Cup player.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a small world. I think he would. You'd see him around with Sky at various tournaments. You would just say to someone, who's your man? Or, you know, that's Andrew Coulthard. Like, the body language was he hit a shot and held the pose and didn't even turn around. I mean, if he doesn't like Coulthard, and I'm Andrew Coulthard in that situation, and I'm live on TV, I'm probably not going near Kuchar. I'm going to stick to the guy I'm talking to, and I'm going to move on and say, there's Kuchar hitting a shot. Like, Coulthard's body language suggested to me a man very confused, like, awkward, what am I, do I actually say to him, Kuch, what's going on? And in the end, Coulthard just said, right, I'm getting out of here, and walked over to the green.
Is there not a fourth option that Coulthard overstepped the mark?
Potentially. I mean, I would agree with that if it was...
That if Kuch isn't 100% familiar with who he is and he clearly knows he's got all the right accreditation, he's working for one of the major broadcasters, if he has that level of access, regardless of he's on the 15th tee and he's sort of jokingly messing about, he doesn't introduce himself. He just randomly walks over and sticks the mic in front of his face. And that actually Kuchar's going, wait a second, it's the day before a major, I'm practicing. I'll decide when I talk to you. You don't get to just put a microphone in front of my face and expect a response.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, it is.
I'd have to accept
that. And that doesn't make him an asshole.
No, no, I'd have to accept that if that was Kuchar's logic. But I mean, it really lingered and lingered on, like, I don't know.
Oh, it lingered.
To ignore someone for that long a period was very uncomfortable. Just like Cooch, the man who Phil Mickelson says is so witty. And, you know, when he saw my crocodile shoes and I told him they were only for a guy who's won the Masters three times, said to him, well, let's just hope I win it too, who has a turn of phrase. Was there no line he could have turned around and made a gag about the fact that he had overstepped the mark, or it's during my practice shot, or here, you know.
My problem is that Phil Mickelson will pick up all the Kuchar stories. He thinks that's the funniest.
Sure. But yeah. You take my point. Like, you could have maybe said something to suggest I wasn't overly keen and you interrupted
me. But we've all been in positions where you've interviewed people who don't want to be interviewed for a number of different reasons. Maybe they're having a bad day and
Darren
they've been
Clark.
Forced in... But once again, they're forced in front of the media. He's out practicing. Maybe he's not expecting to talk to anybody. Maybe something is going on. He doesn't want to talk to anybody. And somehow, a reporter still has a microphone in front of your face.
I'd agree
again,
with
now
that.
Maybe the easy option there is you turn around and go, not today.
Mm. I'm kind of turned around on... my first thought, as I said, was, oh, there must be history here. There must be previous. And maybe, you know, the brazen neck of broadcasting anyway. It's like, look, the job, you have the job to do. So you put personal feelings aside and you pretend, hey, I like everybody. And hey, but, you know... I'm kind of with you more. And in the absence of actual evidence, I'm going to go with the nobody's an asshole.
Fair enough. I'm still in my corner where I took a dim view of it.
Joe starts an asshole and works his way back.
We all have stuff going on. He may not be having a perfect day. I mean, this was not going to be an in-depth interview. This was clearly
a
reporter.
It's a one-liner, isn't
it? What are you working on, Cooch?
Looking for just a line.
Ignoring you, Andrew.
A quick line. This is not going to develop into an interview. And the nature of those practice days is that media are all over the place. They're in between the ropes. That's the kind of deal, you know?
Exactly.
And they're accredited and...
Oh, now I agree with Joe.
And I guarantee
you... come on.
When he wants to get his Grey Goose sponsorship interview, he'll be all shucks and flashing his... You know, he'll be blinking away and smiling at Andrew Coulthard when he wants to go on TV. It did not need much, and it just created a really weird situation. Interestingly, the Sky Sports social media department did like loads of crying, laughing faces when they tweeted it. They were like, look at Cooch blank our Andrew Coulthard. Lots of laughy faces.
That's kind of what we do, though, wouldn't it?
Maybe.
Like, if we're up in Port George and Darren Clark ignores us, which is, I would say, a definite possibility.
Who's doing punditry for Sky here?
We have it in our intro.
Yeah, he was doing it with Sarah Stirk.
Is Darren Clark slapping Dave McIntyre?
Yeah, because it says something about Darren Clark.
Yeah.
I felt this was an embarrassing situation for Coulthard. Like, he's a former professional golfer. This was humiliating for him.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'd spent too much time anyway on it. It's all nonsense. I have arthritis. Cooch is an arsehole. We'll move on. And I think they are all the tweets for now. Let's start talking US Open. We have got Rex Hoggard of the Golf Channel, who's on the way next. So delighted to say the Golf Channel's Rex Hoggard is on the line. And I presume you're somewhere in the Wisconsin area, Rex?
I am in Wisconsin Dairyland, I think is what they call this, right in the middle of the state at Erin Hills.
I hear Erin Hills is basically in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I think you'd have to go to nowhere and take a right and go another 30 miles to
Erin Hills. All right, okay. So, impressions from afar. You know, we've seen Kevin Na's video and then we've seen Rory McIlroy... frankly, shoot him down. So that's been all playing out. The other thing which strikes me is it just looks like a very pretty course. You've got the green of the fairway and the fescue all around it. And, you know, it looks nice. And the fairways do seem to be wide and the greens do seem to be receptive. Jordan Spieth is talking about between 5 and 10 under as being a winning score.
Yeah, you know, it's the great unknown. We haven't been here. They haven't held a professional event here. So it's a little hard to say. I think there was a lot of, I don't want to say concern, but it is. You know, some anticipation. When you show up at a golf course and you've never played it before, you don't know how it's going to react. And, of course, golf courses always change dramatically from Wednesday to Thursday, and you would expect this to do the same thing. But other than the fescue, which was, of course, an issue early in the week, and Kevin Na's video, and I would like to say Lee Westwood probably had the best video with his caddy Billy crawling out of the weeds unseen. There was a lot of very good videos. But I would agree with Rory that they're probably the widest fairways we've ever seen at a U.S. Open. And if it, you're standing on the tee worrying about hitting the ball 50 yards right, then you probably shouldn't be playing in the U.S. Open. I mean, I know that's a little harsh, but I think Rory probably nailed it. And when I actually spoke with Kevin Na about it, I don't think he was making the point that it was unfair. I think he was making the point that someone can get hurt. It's definitely going to slow down play.
Yeah.
There are golf balls that are going to get lost in that rough, and it's going to be, they said they want the pace to be right about 5 hours today. I think it's going to be closer to six. It's just going to be a long, difficult walk.
I've seen Aaron Hill's been compared to Chambers Bay, to Whistling Straits, both of which are remembered more for the controversy, both of which were tournaments Dustin Johnson really should have won. Is that an unfair comparison? Is that just because of the fescue, because of that sort of novelty factor? Whereas actually, if you were to completely ignore the fescue, that Erin Hills is more of a classic U.S. Open course?
No, I wouldn't say it's a classic U.S. Open course by any stretch. There aren't any trees on the property. Again, it's the longest U.S. Open course in history, 77 yards and some change. And if you look at the way the greens are, they're a little bit slower. You don't have nearly as much undulation. And I guess Chambers Bay probably is the closest comparison, although I think they are two different golf courses. But you would look at the type of players that would probably have a really good chance to win here, and it's probably the same list. It's probably short list.
It's got a few interesting quirks. There's a ton of different tee box options. So Mike Davis and the USGA can really mix things up depending on the weather. And you know, any sense that this is a linksy course has been shot down by the players who have all made the point, you've got to really fly it to the greens. So these are the elements they're battling with. One of the reasons I think the course has been talked about so much, alongside the fact that it's new, is that there's no great narrative around any of the big players. Nobody's, you know, right in form. We can't be sure about anyone just now.
Well, I would agree with that entirely. If you consider the three biggest stories this week has been the grass and the cutting grass of grass, which is just an exciting story for all of us to sit around and talk about.
It's why you got into journalism, I presume, Rex.
Writing about grass is what I dreamed about when I was in school. And then the guy that's not going to be here, or may be here depending on what the weather is today, Phil Mickelson, who decided not to attend his daughter's graduation and probably won't make his first round tee time. So, I mean, for those to be the two main stories of the week, it's quite, you know, baffling to me. And I think you're absolutely right. This has a lot to do with, if you look at the top players, Dustin Johnson hasn't, he had that injury at the Masters. This is his first major of the year. Rory McIlroy, coming off the injury, hasn't played since the Players. Jordan Spieth, struggling with his putter. Jason Day, dealing with, of course, family issues of his own with his mother. I think all of those things kind of put question marks on all the top players, and it's really hard to sit here and go, wow, that's the guy to beat. And that's why we're probably focused on all of these other little things.
Yeah.
Rex, one of the things I heard Paul Azinger talk about it was saying that 14 of the 18 holes feature a blind shot or a semi-blind shot?
Yes, that's true. Actually, it was Mike Davis who said that yesterday. I didn't realize that, but during the USGA's press conference, and wow. If you sit and kind of look at it, I will say this, even though everyone's talking about the length and how long this golf course is, the two holes that have stood out, that as I've talked with players and caddies and whatnot, are the two shortest holes on the course, essentially. It's the par 4 second, which is the shortest par 4, and the par 3 ninth, which is the shortest hole on the course at 135 yards. So it's not really about distance. It's really about the second has potentially two blind shots on the hole. And it's a very creative layout. I have to say, even though players have complained about the rough and everything else, the layout itself is very impressive.
Is Mike Davis walking around with a t-shirt saying, please don't hate me, and saying prayers every 10 minutes that this whole thing doesn't go badly, badly wrong?
He pretty much said as much, absolutely. Or maybe, you know, someone put the sign on his back that says, kick me. That's what it feels like it's been like for him the last couple of years. And I think he's very well aware of it. I mean, they know they need a win this week. They know they need a good week.
Last question, because I know you're under a lot of time pressure. Is there anyone in particular you fancy outside of those obvious two, three names who are favorites in the betting?
I wrote this last night, and I've kind of bounced back and forth, and I can't go back on it now because it's in print, so that makes it true, right? So John Rahm would be the guy I think I'm looking at, and I don't know who would consider, you know, he's obviously not a dark horse, but I just like the way, I mean, let's face it, we all know John plays without fear, and I think this is a perfect week where if you can play without fear, if you're not thinking about that fescue rough 50 yards away, that's probably the best mindset, and I think that's John Rahm at his best.
Okay, a lot of sense in that. Listen, we'll be watching your work on the Golf Channel over the next few days. Thanks a million, Rex.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So interesting stuff there from Rex Hargard on a few fronts. The latest, by the way, is that the weather is very good.
Phil has withdrawn.
Oh, he has.
Officially.
Okay. Wind is 10 to 15 miles per hour. And presumably, Amanda Mikkelsen has made her speech and everyone's really happy. And now Phil is realising, what the hell have I done? Was it worth it? Was Amanda's speech that good? Is he having that good a day?
It's a big deal.
Pearl Bones spent the whole week getting his yardages, working his ass off to be ready for 2:20 Central Time.
The other thing...
Central American Time?
Yeah.
Is it Central American?
No, it's Central Time.
Just Central Time. Working his ass off.
The other thing in the Jim Nance-Nicholas thing is they were talking, because Mikkelsen had floated the possibility, or the strong possibility, that he wasn't going to play in the US Open because it conflicted with his daughter's high school graduation.
First time since 1993.
High school or college?
High school.
Okay.
Yeah, so high school. To college to study Egyptian studies.
Okay.
To
so
be to be fair to her, she's the reason she was given the speech is she finished first.
Valedictorian.
First in the class.
Yeah, so, yeah, and so that's a big deal.
I know it is.
It's a huge... But the part was is that, again, rather than simply just tip their hat to Mikkelsen and say, look, you know, this is a guy who's had his issue. You know, his family have been beset by potential tragedy, so it's maybe forced them closer, so he appreciates the value of his kids, so on and so forth. They had to translate this into every golfer would do the same thing. That's Jim Nance's take on it. You know, Mikkelsen's not doing what any of the other guys would do. And it was like, well, clearly he is doing what a lot of other guys wouldn't do. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a big news story.
Yeah, sure. And it's just because he's really running out of time now, you know. And
he's 46.
I think also because
he finished quite well in Memorial last week.
But he made such a story about it. When he made the decision first, I thought that was it. Mm. I'm pulling out of the US Open. I'm going to my daughter's graduation. But then it was... Well, no, I'm still entered.
Yeah.
I've got the weather's not well. Yeah.
And like that just made a mockery of it, because whatever about changing day, surely they could have worked at that. It finishes. If it came down to the space of 2 hours, it makes no sense.
It's a very strange situation, yeah. And Butch was on Sky last night, and he was they showed footage of him on the range with Dustin Johnson, and Bones came over. And Sarah Sturck was saying, what were you saying to him? And they were like, give us your yardage book. You're not going to need it. All the work you've done is a complete waste of time. So no, Phil. River Jones Johnson. River Jones Johnson.
Oh, it's the new baby.
Is the name Dustin. Of DJ's second son, second child.
Second child.
They had a number of names picked out, Butch told us last night. But when River Jones arrived, none of them quite fitted his little face. And they took some time, and River Jones, apparently they looked at that child and said he should be called River.
He looks like a river.
He looks like a river to me, Paulina.
Like River Phoenix.
I suppose so, yeah. Mm. But River Jones it is. World number one, Dustin Johnson, missed the cut and on his last competitive start at the Memorial.
Yeah.
Late arriving here, second son on Monday. Interestingly, he's changed driver this week. He's gone back to the driver he won the US Open with last year. Butch revealing last night in Sky, every player has a club in their bag they hate. For Dustin Johnson, hates three woods. Hates his three wood, never likes his three wood. And he was hitting a load of three woods amazingly well on the range, just watching him, but he doesn't like his three wood. So that's DJ. I mean, missing the cut at the Memorial, he hasn't quite got the amazing, unbelievable momentum he had going into the Masters, but he's still the man to beat.
Since the Masters, or since coming back after missing the Masters, he's had more rounds in the 70s than not.
Yeah, which is obviously complete contrast
to what he was before. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, what is he? I saw the odds, 29-4 he was. So
what?
29-4.
29-4. I've never seen that odds in my life before.
What is that?
7 1/7 to 1.
Yeah. No, that's not real odds. I think you're like,
where did you see that?
You're reading the time.
Last night. No, I picked them up off the American
betting. I see, and the American 29-4 would be an American odds system that he's in Vegas. Yeah, no, he's a very short price. He's about 7 to 1.
Yeah. Why would the Americans think 29-4 is a good idea for
anyone? Because they're probably betting big.
Oh my God.
So yeah, slightly better margins. Than 7 to 1.
Yeah, it's slightly better. Anyway, I'm not a better, so these numbers pass me. I know that 7 to 1 is pretty good, or is pretty low odds in a 156 man field. I'd put money on him to finish top 5, but I don't think, says he,
I don't think he's got a win in him this week.
You were reading a piece on Noam Shipnuck.
But just what Rex Hoggard was saying there.
Oh, yeah.
So, like Chambers Bay, if that is the course it's most similar to, he should have won that tournament.
I've heard, and actually the logic still stands, but I've heard a lot of the players, I was watching a thing, funny enough, when Matt Kuchar was ignoring Andrew Coulthard, that Graham McDowell and Shane Lowry were doing with a journalist, walking a hole with them, chatting, and they made the Whistling Straits comparison. Now again, DJ
should have won
a major there. So,
and also, Dave yesterday was giving a stat about when you look at major venues that are either new or haven't been used for 20 years, I think it was, that it's almost always one of the top three players in the world who wins it.
Okay.
And Dustin is in a position that he hits the ball so far and so well off the tee that he's going to give himself an advantage on pretty much every course. And think how wide the fairways are.
Yeah.
That's going to...
Yeah. I agree. I mean,
work for him perfectly.
But he's also... There hasn't been a repeat winner of the US Open since Curtis Strange.
He leads, stats-wise, so he leads the PGA Tour in strokes gained off the tee, which may not be a huge surprise.
Yeah.
The best driver in the world. He also leads the tour in strokes gained approach to the green as well. And that's the part of his game he was talking about as well, how he used to never lay up in par fives because I felt I could chip it closer than I was going to wedge it. But now it's the other way around. I feel like I can wedge it closer than I can chip it.
Yeah.
Which makes a huge difference to his game. Now, I do wonder, well, maybe the results bear it out, that mentally he actually is in the position now where instead of always saying, I'll just go for it, he does think a bit more sensibly and does take that option a bit more often. Yeah, Alan Shipnuck has a great piece this week on DJ and his brother AJ, who is his caddy, and the upturn in fortune since AJ became his caddy. Unfortunately, Bobby Brown, who was his previous caddy, and remember, like, we're talking about an upturn in fortune. He had won, I think, for the previous 7 years on the PGA Tour before he changed caddy. But Bobby Brown, who was his then caddy, was having a child. So he was over playing in Asia. He was having a good time with his brother, was sitting on the beach, clocking up the numbers, he said, and going, well, I'm going to have to fly my brother back to America, fly Bobby back here, all of this first. It's going to cost me a lot of money. Maybe if you just stayed for one more tournament, Bobby gets extra paternal leave. And then he went to a World Golf Championship, won it, and thought, actually, I trust this guy more than anybody in the world. He's my little brother.
It's tough and Bobby.
We're keeping all the money in the family.
Yeah.
Surely this makes perfect sense.
He's just had a child.
But they were talking about Dustin's relaxed manner and maybe the fact that some people think he's a little bit dumb at times. So during last year's Ryder Cup at Hazeltine, Dustin faced a sloping middle-length putt that plainly had 2 or 3 feet of right-to-left break. After conferring with his brother, he started the ball a yard left of the hole, missing the putt by at least 6 feet. Had the tension short-circuited his stroke or perhaps clouded his vision, even though it was just a Ryder Cup practice round? In his soft South Carolina drawl, Dustin offered his brother a different explanation. Aw, man, I the green reading book upside down.
That's pretty good.
Give your fake laugh, Joe.
Oh, did you tell that story
yesterday? I laughed yesterday at the story, yeah. Okay. I couldn't bring myself to
I think it's a good story.
Yeah. No, it's a great story. But, but I was saying, I made the point yesterday, like, you know, you stand over a putt and it's very obvious sometimes what way it's breaking. If you looked at a piece of paper and said it was breaking the other way, you would look back at it and go, no. You would think something's wrong. Whereas DJ seemed to just look at it and go, okay. And hit the putt. Butch addressed the whole, is he stupid, dilemma.
And said he's not.
Yesterday. He didn't say he was not stupid. No, he did. He didn't fake it and give it this whole, oh no, he's far more intelligent than people think. No, he didn't do that. But he just said, I've never come across somebody who just doesn't care about what's just happened. And it's the greatest temperament imaginable for a golfer. You know, so Sarah Sterk was saying, you know, does he think he even this week he's been asked about the putt he missed at Chambers Bay. But just like, he hasn't thought about that. He hadn't thought about that in years. He's done. He doesn't care.
He definitely has an uncluttered mind. But it reminds me, I read an interview years and years ago where a guy had gone to spend time with Michael Schumacher. And Schumacher, in his career, was renowned as one of the most intelligent racing car drivers there was, because not only was he an exceptional driver, but he worked with the team, he worked on the engine, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And so he went to spend time and talk. And whoever the author of the piece was surprised to discover that Schumacher had nothing to say and thought nothing about anything other than just racing cars.
Sure, it's the price
and
you
so,
pay.
So the idea was is that, wow, this man who is a genuine intellectual when it comes to his chosen field really is just like pig ignorant when it comes to everything else. And yeah. and that jarred with the author. And so he wrote about it in the piece. And I wonder if that's not the case with an awful lot of athletes. And with someone like Dustin Johnson, he just kind of wears it so openly, you know, that
I don't know. I think in just generally the way he speaks, I'm not sure he's an intellectual.
He's quite unusual
giant.
In golf as well, because golf of all sports yeah. has so many smart people playing it.
Yeah. I mean, I must say
I don't think
think it does have a lot. Yeah,
I think maybe. Yeah.
Well, most of them have gone through college
yeah.
right to the very end.
Yeah,
they're well educated.
Sorry,
you're coming from a better background
you
automatically.
Yeah, I think it's way ahead of other sports.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I suppose
we've got to move on.
I don't think DJ is stupid as kind of just his. He just focuses all of his whatever intellect he has on this very narrow thing. Mm. That's all.
I think he's a bit stupid person. Mm. I listen to him talk, and I'm just. Like,
but is that not just you prejudiced against his South Carolina accent, which does come across a bit? It's a bit Simpson-y. He goes, "Well, I ate the critter, and then I ate me some roadkill."
No, I just.
There's just not a lot going on.
I think there's not much going on.
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
That's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, sure.
It
no, absolutely.
But on the Schumacher thing, I'm always suspicious of anyone who pretends to be an expert in everything. And they're out there on Twitter in particular, because you can bluff your way at 140 characters. There's no way you know everything about everything.
It's true. You're absolutely right.
It's just not enough
time. Name names, Joe.
I mean, 10 names, I could rattle them off, but I just couldn't be bothered. Number one. So, Rory then. Let's talk Rory. Rory has a spider red putter. It will be the first time in history that the top three ranked golfers in the world are all using the same putter. DJ and Jason Day love their spider red putter. Rory McIlroy mentioning recently that he sees DJ now most days. They hang out most days because they're practicing in the same area of the world in Florida. So they've become good friends, him and fellow
TaylorMade
sponsor. Yeah.
Good Christ.
No wonder Tiger's in rehab.
Oh, dear.
Oh, listen.
We were best friends. Oh, dear. So anyway, Rory. So, I mean, Rory hasn't played since the Players. He says, there isn't any panic setting in, but it would be nice to get my name on another major pretty soon. He's talked about playing too tentatively in first rounds of too many majors. He wants to go out and relax and hit it well. He's obviously shot down Kevin Na and talked about the width of the fairways. How he's going to go, we don't know. When people hear this podcast, they'll have a much better idea. For my money, I'll throw it to you too. And I said it yesterday. His short game at the Masters was as good as it's ever been. He's never put it as well consistently, I felt, and certainly the chipping was outrageously good, and it was his long game which messed him up because he was playing with a ball and equipment he was just not comfortable with. If he can replicate the short game, and if he's continued to practice that the way he clearly had been before the Masters, if he can replicate the short game and get six, even seven, hit 7 out of 10 for his long game, then he's got a real chance. Now, Paul McGinley last night said, no, don't fancy him. It's too hard at a major to come in this rusty. He says, I think Rory will be top 10, maybe top 5, but to actually win this...
A Sunday, put in a low number on Sunday?
Yeah, maybe.
Day, Saturday.
Reverse in. I mean, that's the pattern of Rory at the moment. Mm. He's talking about that himself when he says too tentative in majors. But McGinley last night said it's too much of an ask.
I go along with McGinley.
So yeah.
Even right. What you're talking about there about the Masters, yeah, short game was brilliant.
Yeah.
His putting was brilliant.
Yeah.
He has a new putter.
Which is brilliant.
Since the Masters.
I know.
He has a new ball since the Masters.
Which he loves.
And he has barely played since the Masters.
And other players he hangs out with who happen to play TaylorMade, he hangs out with them all the time.
Yeah.
It is worth pointing out that he has Dominion on his side. He's going for major number 5. And he's won a greater percentage of tournaments by quite a considerable margin than every other player in the field.
Oh, when he's on, he's on.
It's unreal. Like, but the problem, as he says himself, and I thought he was very measured in whoever he was talking to, Greg Allen, earlier in the week.
Why were you doing listening to Greg Allen? News talk or nothing.
Oh, okay. So I was listening to this other guy who...
Who is this Greg Allen you speak of?
He's
no, go on. I'm a big Greg Allen fan.
So, and Greg Allen asked him, are you a bit worried? You know, is it... When do you start worrying? He goes, not yet. It's been, you know, nearly 3 years.
About not winning a major.
Not winning a major.
Right, sure, yeah.
Nearly 3 years. And he goes, it's not time to worry just yet. But he goes, look, if it goes on a bit longer, I would start worrying.
See, I suppose there's been such mitigating circumstances. Like he missed 2015 because of the football injury. And now this year...
He got married this year.
And the rib.
Changed.
I mean, he hasn't played and he's changed equipment. So, like 2 of the last 3 years have been write-offs.
Yeah, write-offs. And so, but, you know, winning is a habit.
He's heading for 30.
And he is.
At a pretty rapid rate. This is his ninth US Open.
Yeah, it's true. Look, he has pissed away three or four majors. There's
he
no
has
doubt.
Seven to win five before 30, which would put him in that elite field, I think, with Nicklaus, Jones and Tiger Woods.
What about Gary Player?
No. Oh. No, Gary Player, thankfully.
Letter, I
they're the only ones to have won five or more majors before the age of 30. He has seven goes to go after this one.
That's
so,
all.
Yeah. But he only has to win is one.
Oh, okay. But he really has messed up the last 3 years, really.
Do you want a stat?
Yes.
So, if you're interested in golf stats, the man to follow is Justin Ray from the Golf Channel, who is their resident statistician. Major championship performance since the beginning of 2013.
We've all seen this stat at this stage.
I haven't. Go on. Go on.
Just because you've seen it.
Go on.
Doesn't mean everyone's seen it.
Go on.
Comparing Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy. Number of wins.
Oh, it's the one that were exactly the
it's
same.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is unbelievable.
But we haven't had a podcast since.
It's unbelievable to the point that I was listening to the BBC last night and they were trying, as the BBC must, they were like, we haven't been able to fully verify this or stand this up yet, but we think it's true, but we don't know.
Same number of wins.
Can't verify it.
It's taking a lot of time.
Well, because it goes down to the detail of number of strokes. Jordan Spieth, 4,108. Rory McIlroy, 4,108.
Over what period again?
Since 2013, the beginning of 2013.
Oh my God, I didn't realize it was over that long a period. Wow.
4 years.
So 17 majors.
And they played the same number of rounds, same number of shots, the same number of everything.
58 rounds, 21 rounds in the 60s, same number of shots, so same scoring average, same score to par.
It's just incredible. So Rory with his spider red putter, do you know what? I'm giving him a top five, and I think, just based on an interview, and I know you can put too much stock in Rory interviews, because 6 months later he says, oh, you know,
he says the same thing.
But he talked at length about the process he's gone through to get his equipment sorted, and he's really given a lot of time to it, and he's really worked with different balls, different clubs, and he says, I'm no longer doing what I did previously. I'm now, if the club or ball doesn't suit my swing, it's gone. And he said his numbers are just amazingly good. Like, so I don't know, I just feel like if he gets momentum, he's in with a chance. Shane Lowry, obviously top 10 at the PGA at Wentworth, 13th at Memorial, talking about the fact he has two top 10 US Opens in 2 years. I like tough golf. I like the challenge of going out there making pars. Don't know what it's going to play like, but if you hit the driver well, you're not going to be coming into these greens with much, and they are going to be receptive, is Lowry's thought. And then Graham McDowell is now eighth on tour this season for strokes gained putting. Remember, his putting had fallen away a bit. McDowell's now back in the top 10 in the world, really, for putting. And the other point is, even though, as Rex said, this is the longest course in US Open history, the word Philip Reed is out there, obviously, for the Times. And the medium hitters are very happy. There's a lot of strategy. And by all accounts, if you catch the right part of the fairway, you can really shorten up this golf course. So it's not a fait accompli that you're going to have to be a 300-yard guy to win it. So that's Lowry, Paul Dunn's out there, Graham McDowell's out there. Any people we want to talk about?
Kid America, Jordan Spieth.
Oh, well, yeah. How can you forget Jordan Spieth? Yeah. Nathan Murphy said in yesterday's pod, if it was down to his last 10 euro in any major,
you'd stick it on Jordan. I know Rex is saying, and he's right, and he's had his putting issues this year, I mean, relatively speaking, but he seems to have sorted those out.
Yeah.
He's striking the ball better. He's driving the ball better. He's probably not the dominant golfer he was 2 years ago. Who is? But if you were, I'm with Nathan, if you were to put money down, I'm putting it on Spieth. And you know, he could miss the cut, you know, but
yeah. I did say as well that my one concern with Spieth, having watched him quite a bit over the last couple of months, is the brain fart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one hole that seems to destroy his tournament. And this course, while may not be as difficult as some US Open courses because of that fescue rough, one bad mistake, one terrible drive could destroy your entire, and probably will for 50 players.
Butch
this week
was saying last night that his the strategy, he sat down with all my guys, you know, Ricky and Dustin, and the strong advice is, if you go in that stuff, you take your highest lofted wedge and you chip out sideways. And you
100%.
Take bogey. And that has to be the strategy, because if you go for it and the club turns over, blah, 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 you're just going to make double or triple.
Mm.
That's like, I agree with you about Speed. Funny, my strategy with Speed now at majors is he's unbackable odds, but like at Augusta, wait for that horror score and then bet him when his odds go out a bit, because he's just so resilient.
There's a lot. There's, again, you can go down through the list and make cases for people. So Rex was talking about John Rahm, Hideki Matsuyama, Ricky Fowler, Justin Thomas. None of them have won a major yet, and that's probably the question mark around all of them. Some of them have never even really contended properly in a major yet. But Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth have played here before. So they played here in the 2011 the US Amateur. I don't know if that stands to them, having that little bit of
four rounds
extra experience, having spent a week there. Further down, I think maybe there's some value, if you want to call it that. I always like some of the Americans, like Kevin Chappell has been playing really well lately. Yeah. Billy Horschel has a win. Players like that who have a bit of confidence, who have a win recently.
What about Fowler?
Butch last night, I think he's getting frustrated with him. Butch was sort of saying, look, I talked to Ricky. He said, was saying, Ricky has a habit of messing up towards the end of a round. Some kind of concentration issue or...
I was looking at some of the...
But he's just, Butch's line was, he doesn't win enough.
Yeah. Clearly he doesn't win enough. Apparently the smooth greens are going to play for Fowler. He's seventh this season in strokes gained putting.
Is he?
Spieth is 40th, you know. I mean, the aforementioned problems. And, you know, so on the one hand, so he's missed the last two cuts, but he finished tied 10th and 2nd in the two before that. He's also missed three cuts this season, so he's had a kind of a slightly mercurial play. But he also, you know, he finished tied 2nd at Memorial. He's won, tied 2nd twice, tied 3rd twice, tied 4th, 6th, 11th, 12th and 14th. Mm. So he's kind of in play in a lot of tournaments. I mean, look it.
Maybe this is a better run-in for him. Clearly he wouldn't want to have missed two cuts.
No.
But every major we seem to say, it's on for Fowler. Look at the way he's playing.
Absolutely. Do you know what's funny, actually, and it's true, this podcast now, it strikes me, and because I'm just thinking, God, is there anyone else we should mention? And it's true of every other preview I've heard. Bizarrely, I've not heard the words Justin Rose or Sergio Garcia mentioned. And Justin Rose, obviously a former US Open winner, and Sergio must be feeling good about life. But, you know, it's weird. No one seems to be kind of fancying them for whatever reason.
They haven't played a huge amount of golf since then.
You would think Sergio probably has had an unusual couple of months, not practiced as much. But is it just people don't think Rose can bounce back so quickly? McIlroy did it.
Mm. And he's so steady.
Yeah. Because you've got to think back. Like at Augusta, his caddy was saying, this guy is playing the best golf I've ever seen him play.
Yeah. Nathan, you're the gambler of the three of us. I've got one for you. Like a real long odds guy. Jason Niebrugge. 250-1. But here's why, right? Do you remember him? He finished, he got a top 10 at the Open
say no.
in 2015 as an amateur.
We were just talking about it yesterday.
You weren't.
No.
Oh, we've done all this yesterday.
Yeah.
Niebrugge. Yeah.
He's not announced.
Here's the thing.
Odds-wise, he might be announced.
We had him on the phone.
Yeah.
He's played Erin Hills a bunch of times because he's from Wisconsin.
Right, okay. Right. Well, Steve Stricker has qualified. Wisconsin's favourite son, he's qualified.
Oh.
And I just... I think it's possible that he has a good
It'd
run.
It'd be great if it would. Yeah.
Listen, what I think is, if you're going for a really long odds outsider, there's a guy called Taylor Gooch. Probably don't know a huge amount about him. I certainly know nothing about him, but I have a feeling he's going to start well, and who knows where it'll go from there. John McHenry is a piece. I thought this was maybe the point you were going to make about how there's no outstanding favourite, even though Dustin Johnson is in around 7-1, how it is so wide open.
Just,
and he is a piece in the Examiner of we need a superstar to emerge from the pack to replace Tiger. But then he contradicts his point by saying modern day mitigating factors possibly dictate otherwise. And I think he's definitely right about that when you look at Rory. Jason Day, Dustin Johnson, Jordan Spieth. We never mentioned Jason Day.
I was just about to say, if this place is as similar to Whistling Straits as they're all saying, then that suddenly brings Jason Day's name into the frame, given his performance there at the
USPGA. We spend a lot of time talking about American golfers. Like, we rarely talk about, say, like Thomas Peters. Think how good he was.
John Rahm.
At the Masters,
I think
at the Masters.
Right.
Yeah. John Rahm, yeah.
No, Rex is right.
Paul McGinley said last night he's the best player he's seen come on tour since Tiger Woods.
Adam Scott?
Adam Scott has been tipped by a lot of people.
Scott's
watched him last week.
He's putting well. Now, look, he's put in well, like he can do sometimes from 20 feet. Like, he'll roll a few in, you think, oh, he's got it cracked. And then it's the 5-6-footers. Like, do you ever feel good over Scott from 7 feet?
I think the stats from certainly last week or the last couple of weeks were he had lost a shot around on the greens.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, look, maybe...
And how does that turn out then on the back nine of a major?
Yeah. Putting is obviously something that you can just have a really, really good day or two or three or four, more so than any aspect of your game.
Absolutely.
That's what he needs to happen. You'd never rule him out.
Sneds is 80-1. There's a good outside bet.
Yeah.
For absolutely no reason other than we like Brant Snedeker.
Yeah.
I backed my two bets, and I'll go in again at the weekend when it sort of sorted itself out a little bit more. And as you say, maybe Jordan Spieth is a little bit of value at that stage. Or Kevin Chappell, 66-1.
Right.
And Billy Horschel, 80-1.
Ah, come on, Billy.
I saw some other tips at Billy Horschel.
Oh, yeah, Billy.
People were talking about Billy Horschel.
Are we pretty much done?
We're done. I just wanted to, I forgot, it would be a good friend of ours, of yours and mine, Joe, and a long-time listener. Ivor O'Sullivan's birthday today, so happy birthday, Ivor.
Ivor O'Sullivan is a champ of a man.
He is an absolute champ.
Has tremendous luck in terms of getting picked out for off-the-ball golf days.
Always seems to come out of the name. Name comes out of the hatch, yeah.
So
yeah.
I think Ivor, I think he's 50-something or...
Five?
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe
I think it's 55.
He's
55, yeah.
Yeah, he's 55.
He would be. He's a man who loves his podcasts.
Absolutely, yeah.
He's a sales rep, so he's often in the car.
Listening to podcasts.
Yeah.
He also loves a good bargain on golf equipment.
Never pretends to be at work and does deals from the golf course, either.
No.
Wouldn't do that. Happy 55th, Ivor.
Happy 55th, Ivor.
He's a hell of a man. I know he is. He's a champ.
Yeah.
Are you going to upload this, or are you just going to save it to the system?
I'm going to edit it. I'm going to spend time editing it and then save it in the system it was already in.
And people get it there.
And make a point of saying to you,
I don't know if Anonymous or someone can hack the Newstalk servers and just upload these things.
We're going to say goodbye. And if you're looking at it going, God, there's still an awful lot of time left on this podcast, that is because we are going to give you some bonus US Open nostalgia, which was on Off the Ball the other evening. But if you missed it, it is 25 years since Tom Kite won his only major. He won the US Open at Pebble Beach. He beat Nick Faldo off and Ian Woosnam off. It was a terribly difficult final day. The greens were baked. It was windy. And Tom Kite shot one of the great final round 72s, level par, and won his only major. He was 42 years old, Tom Kite, and he was the best player never to have won a major of his day.
Yeah.
And so we talked to him about that and his cameo on The Simpsons.
Go on, pick your winning score.
Pick my winning score.
Oh, look, if Jordan Spieth says between 5 and 10 under...
I'll go 7 under.
I'm going to go 4 under.
9.
Under?
Yeah.
I just think they're looking at it now and they're like, oh, it's easy enough. I still think, despite what the USGA say about not wanting low scores and not wanting par, I think if the scores are too good, they will destroy them with the tee boxes. Like, Brandel Chamblee was on giving out about this, saying the tee boxes are all over the shop. They can do untold damage.
Is that in terms of you can't plan because...
Yeah.
So you go out, you do play in your practice round, and then you actually tee box is 50 yards to the left.
Correct.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So it was like... So the Chamblee's line was, it's disrespectful to the amount of preparation they do. Like, Jesus, you know, that they're so finely tuned. They do so much practice work. They do so many recces, and then they don't play in a single tee box of a day that they've seen before. And it's just wrong, was his general take. But... And also, they'll find a way, you know, they'll speed up the greens, they'll do something. They just want, I just don't think they'll want another congressional again. But
it's the USGA. They'll do something stupid.
But it is playing to 72, the first time in forever.
Interestingly, the first time since Tom Kite won the US.
Oh, Open is it?
Tom Kite. I wonder what that guy's at now.
Only we have.
Yeah. So, okay, so I'll go 4, you're saying 7, and you're saying 9.
Yeah.
Who are you tipping?
Spieth.
Rory McIlroy, which would be a hell of a call. Well, not maybe a little, a moderately
good call. In terms of hell of a call.
Well, you mean the number two player in the world, the guy who's won more majors than anyone else in the field.
That guy. I'm tipping that guy.
Hell of a call.
Yeah,
yeah, well done.
Okay, we're done. And I'm really looking forward to this, actually. So this is going to be good. We'll talk to you next week. Good luck. Tom Kite retired with 19 PGA Tour victories. He competed on 7 Ryder Cup teams. He was the US captain for the 1997 Ryder Cup and was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2004. And of course, he was the winner of the US Open 25 years ago at Pebble Beach. Tom Kite, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you guys.
Where are you in the world at the moment?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
Which is home. Yep.
And I should have added to your list of very, very impressive credentials an excellent cameo on The Simpsons where you gave Homer a lesson.
Yeah, I gave Homer, well, actually Homer just raided my locker and took my shoes out of my locker. I told him he could keep them.
Can I take you back? Because we do want to talk to you about 1992 and that US Open, which is 25 years ago, obviously. But I was struck by the fact that obviously you were born in Texas and you and Ben Crenshaw and plenty of others, obviously, you were taught by the great Harvey Penick. And for non-golfing fans who are listening in, Penick is just one of the most celebrated teachers in the game of golf. He has a book called Harvey Penick's Little Red Book, which is almost like a sacred text in the world of golf instruction. So you learned from a genuine legend, Tom.
Exactly. Harvey was phenomenal. He was so smart and so intelligent, not only about the game of golf, but he really understood people and understood what it took to motivate them and to be able to teach them in such a way that all of his students got better, not just a little bit better. They got a lot better. And you start with him. Harvey Penick is in the World Golf Hall of Fame. Ben Crenshaw is in the World Golf Hall of Fame. Betsy Rawls is in the World Golf Hall of Fame. Mickey Wright's in the World Golf Hall of Fame. And of course I am. So you've got a number of his students that grew up taking lessons from him that are in the Hall of Fame. So it's quite a legacy that he has.
Mm. I was listening to Ben Crenshaw's induction speech, well, your induction into the World Golf Hall of Fame, and Crenshaw spoke, and he talked about your work ethic in particular. Said you were just a practicer, grinded out, you know, very much in the Ben Hogan school of golf practicing. And he said, you know, very few players he ever saw worked harder than you. And, you know, him, by contrast, Penick would just send him out to play. He just liked playing. But he said Penick would send him out to play and then go to the practice ground and just watch you hit ball after ball after ball after ball. Clearly something you liked doing, or, you know, something you just always did, I presume.
Well, it's always something that I enjoyed doing, but I will correct you a little bit. You know, Harvey, being a great teacher that he was, knew that I loved to practice and spend hours and hours on the practice tee, and he was always encouraging me to go to the golf course.
Right.
Ben, on the other hand, did not like to practice much. He loved to just play, and Harvey always encouraged him to spend a little bit more time on the practice tee. So not only did he know who we were, but he also knew what we needed, and so he gave us that. But in regard to my time spent on the practice tee and spent on the golf course and spent on the chipping green and putting greens, if some parents dropped a 10-year-old kid or a 12-year-old kid at the golf course early one morning during the summer months and dropped them at the course early and picked them up, right before dinner, everybody would say, boy, that kid loves to play golf. He loves to be out there associating with his friends and he's trying to get a little better. You know, it's playing golf when you're 10 or 12 and all of a sudden you get out on tour, you get a little older, and now all of a sudden everybody says, oh, he works really hard. No, I'm just a 67-year-old kid that still loves to be dropped off at the golf course early in the morning. I love to spend all day out there playing and practicing golf.
Tom, the sort of unassuming way you're speaking to us right now, it kind of is an illustration of the way you conducted yourself on the golf course as well. You didn't tend to have that sort of usual Texas swagger, aside from the hat, which was a little bit of a giveaway. But I wonder, at what stage did you have this little bit of a belief that this is actually something I could make a living from, that I could be good enough to turn pro, let alone maybe one day become a major champion?
Well, I don't think anybody ever knows for sure, but I saw my first professional tournament when I was 10 years old, and I came home and told Dad and Mom that that's what I wanted to do. So from the time I was 10 years old, that was always in the back of my mind that I was going to try my best to get out on the PGA Tour. And you know, everything that I did throughout my entire life and am still doing in my life right now is trying to become the best player that I could. You know, obviously, if you're a really, really good player, the PGA Tour is where you end up, and that's ultimately what happened to me.
If we set the context ahead of 92, you are cemented in the top 10 of world golf. You've won a lot of money. You've had near misses in the major championships. You finished second at the Masters in 83, and very famously, of course, in 86 with Jack, you finished second, and there's another US Open, I think, in 89 where you have a chance, and there are other chances. So you are that guy that nobody wants to be, the best player never to have won a major tag. That is the kind of mantle around your neck at 42 years of age ahead of the 92 US Open?
Well, you know, everybody puts that mantle, as you said, around their neck. But unfortunately, most everybody refuses to complete that sentence. And the word that they leave off of that sentence is yet. You know, the best player in the world to never win a major championship yet. And that changes the whole perspective of the question. It takes it from a negative connotation to a positive connotation. The guy's going to win a major championship. He just hasn't done it yet.
And sorry to interrupt, was that very much your mindset at the time in 1992, or were you beginning to worry?
That was totally my mindset.
Right.
You know, I never lost faith in my ability to play and my ability to compete. And if I had lost faith and in my ability, well, then obviously I probably would never have won that U.S. Open. We just saw a tremendous example in April of a person who had never won a major championship yet. And there were many, many naysayers that wanted to dump on Sergio and wanted to just tell him what an incomplete career he had. And now we look at him and we're praising him. And on the eve of the U.S. Open, he's certainly one of the favorites to possibly win back-to-back major championships. So I think a lot of it has to do with being able to maintain a positive attitude when everybody around you is really downplaying your ability and your talent and the success that you've had. So I had always surrounded myself with positive people. My parents were very, very positive. Harvey Pinnock was unbelievably positive, and everybody that I hung around and chose to spend time with were positive people, and that certainly helped me get to the opportunity to win the U.S. Open.
25 years ago, the U.S. Open was at Pebble Beach, and U.S. Opens at Pebble Beach have a iconic feel to them. Jack won a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. Tom Watson won a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. Subsequent to you, Tiger won. And obviously in this part of the world, we're very well aware that Graham McDowell won one. But you're talking Jack, Tiger, Tom Watson. Like, that's the caliber of player which seems to emerge at a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. You liked Pebble Beach. You'd done well there in those previous U.S. Opens there. So you must have felt pretty good going into it, even more than just your general play.
Yeah, exactly. That was... actually played in the 1972 U.S. Open that Jack won. That was my second U.S. Open to play in, and I was still an amateur at the time. And I went out there as I had been a Walker Cup player and runner-up to Lanny at the U.S. Amateur, and so they gave me a great pairing. The first two rounds, I was paired with Jerry Hurd and Arnold Palmer. And as a 22-year-old amateur player, that'll put a lump in your throat for sure. And so I went out there very nervous. I got got off to a terrible start, shot 41 on the front nine. And as I've related so many times, you know, recently because of Arnold's passing, Arnold came up to me on the ninth fairway, took those big mitts of his on my shoulders and said, "Tom, you're a better golfer than this. Settle down. Show us what kind of player you are." And that settled me down significantly. I came back with 34 on the backside and shot 75 in some very, very difficult conditions. And then came back and made the cut, shot a good round the second day, made the cut, and ended up a low amateur in that U.S. amateur, so, I mean, in that U.S. Open. Mm. So that, I've had a great love affair with that golf course.
Ahead of the final round in 92, you're three under after three rounds. The final round, it seems like, I mean, the USGA obviously don't like particularly low numbers, so they dry out the whole course. There's windy conditions. The greens are baked. They're lightning fast. Par is an amazing score here. Ian Woosnam, I think he was tied with you on the final day. I'm pretty sure he was tied with you. He shot a 79. Nick Faldo was a stroke behind you. He carded a 77. And you just went out and played one of the best ever even par rounds of golf that people have seen, really, certainly at on a Sunday at a major. One of the real high points was the famous seventh hole, which is that famous par three downhill, maybe 100-odd yards, and you were just off the green. And, you know, these are difficult moments. And you can have a listen to the commentary as you try and chip on and get up and down for your par three.
Now it is Tom Kite at seven.
He's pitching the ball back into the wind. It may help a little.
Easy. Hit it.
Montgomery watching on our monitor, sitting inside here at even par.
The listeners obviously heard the reference to Montgomery. He'd shot a 70 early in the day, and I think on the TV coverage, Jack Nicklaus had congratulated him, said, "You're going to be the winner," because conditions worsened as the day went on. And his face as he watches you chip in for birdie on seven is a man who's worried.
Well, yeah, that was one of those days where it was a pretty difficult day starting out, and as you said, it got significantly more difficult as the day went on. You know, the steady winds at 30 or 35 miles an hour with some gusts over 40 miles an hour throughout the day, and with the greens, Pebble Beach has the smallest set of greens of any major golf course in the world. Most of those greens are, well, I think there's only one or two greens that are over 4,000 square feet. So they're very, very small. And, it just, when they get firm, it's almost impossible to hit those greens in regulation. So the scores were high throughout the day. The average score was north of 78. And, I was very fortunate in that I had a great day of, scrambling and hitting the ball very well and make very clutch putts and even that chip shot as you replayed that allowed me to shoot even par and there were two people that finished under par. I was three under, Jeff Sluman was one under, and as you said, Colin finished even par. And you know, I'd say that right now you'd probably have to say that certainly in modern times, the best player to never have won a major championship yet is Colin Montgomery. You know, and of course, in his case, because he's not playing any tournaments on the PGA Tour now or not playing any of the major championships, you know, he may go down as the best player never to win a major.
What do you remember about the celebrations or the emotions? Were you with your family? Did you hang out with other players that mm-hmm. night? What do you remember about it?
Yeah, that was a great day for us. My parents were out there and my wife was out there, and you know, we celebrate Father's Day, which is always the Sunday of the U.S. Open, and to have my parents out there with me at that time, along with my wife, was perfect. It was a very low key celebration, but with people that I really cared about.
Did you feel
like a different guy in the days and the weeks and the months after that? Did it have a material effect on your demeanor or your life or the way your perspective was built? How much of a change outside of just the title being Tom Watkite Major Champion, how much of a change did it actually make to you?
You know, certainly the way people perceive me and think of me changed. As far as my life, I don't feel like it changed a whole lot. I was already well established on the PGA Tour and was doing some really nice things, nice accomplishments, which I was very proud. I had a great family that was already well established and great relationships with my family and some very, very close friends, and that didn't change.
A completely incidental point, but I ask you this as someone who plays golf with glasses. Do they not drive you nuts most of the time? And rain, when it rains, it's just an absolute nightmare.
You know, it's an outdoor sport. it's one of those things that I had to deal with when I wore glasses. You know, if you're going to look for excuses for not playing well, that's certainly as good a one as you can come up with. I wear glasses, so I can't play in the rain. Okay, yeah, that's good. But when it rains, does that mean you're going to shoot a bad score? If it does, well, then you're in the wrong business.
Tom, it's one of my favorite excuses.
You know, there's a million of them, or a billion of them. There's never a shortage of excuses, but ultimately what we're trying to do is play the best golf that we can. Making excuses is never productive, so I never worried about wearing glasses out there. It's just part of the deal.
Mm. A definite very last and very unfair question, right? But we don't often get to talk to people who have played in the same tournaments or with Nicholas and Palmer and Tiger Woods, who you finished second to even in 97. For you, who's been, I mean, the greatest is often a difficult word to use, but maybe your favourite player, the player who impressed you the most? You can go for greatest if you want. The player whose game, when it was at its best, was the most impressive, Tom?
Well, Jack was the best player that I ever played with. Actually, you know, Tiger was, when I played with him those first few years that he was on tour, he was certainly not as accomplished a player as he later became. You know, I turned 50 in the year 2000, and so I started playing more and more on the Champions Tour, and that's when Tiger really came into his own and really started becoming the dominant player. So I really didn't have a chance to play with him when he was at his best, but I did play with Jack when he was at his best, and it was very, very impressive the way he controlled the ball and controlled his mind and just handled the golf course. But in terms of controlling the golf ball and being the best ball striker, you know, everybody talks about Ben Hogan, but I never saw him play. But the best that I ever saw was Lee Trevino.
Nice.
He never missed fairways, never missed greens, always controlled the ball. And, you know, had he been a little bit longer off the tee, you know, he probably would have been, you know, as, you know, had the record that Jack did or come very close to it. Short game wise, you know, you'd have to put Gary Player up there. That you know, obviously he didn't have the length, but he had the mental fortitude and the great short game to allow him to compete at a high level. So those guys were all very, very good.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, Tom Watson, my contemporary Tom Watson. You know, he just did everything well.
Mm. Tom, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. 25 years since Pebble Beach, time flies and all that. Thanks a million.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's been 25 years, but I heard this morning it's been 50 years since Jack won his Open at Baltusrol. So, golly, you know, as a kid growing up in Texas, I can remember watching Jack beat Arnold and Marty Fleckman coming down the stretch. So the 50 years and the 25 years just seem to fly by. But it's been a good run. Nice to be with you guys this morning.
All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all Picketown. Oh.
starter kit right here.